This interview with David Yenken and Jane Holt on the 20th of March in 2003 at his home in South Melbourne, Albert Park. Yes. David, can you tell me how you first became interested in landscape architecture?
Well, I suppose I've been interested in different aspects of the landscape for a long time. And probably my interest stemmed from painting as much as anything else, landscape painting. I've always been interested in landscapes in a more general sense. But my interest overall was greatly stimulated by the fact that throughout my childhood, we had Australian paintings, even though my parents travelled widely overseas. We had paintings that were very evocative of this country. I'd visited the country on a number of occasions and spent a little bit of time here during my childhood. So by the time I came back here, it wasn't an unfamiliar landscape. So that was my beginning. And then when I came to live here, I started a small gallery, and that drew me into contact with a lot of significant painters. And a few of the paintings around this room are those that came from that period, others I've collected since. So that was probably my beginning, and that, I think, influenced me more than books or anything else. And then later, I started a firm called Merchant Builders. That followed on from work I'd done in developing Mertels when Mertels were not really, well, there were none in Australia. In working on those Mertels, I had to find architects, and I had to find landscapers. So I was involved then immediately with people who had skills in those two areas. And the two architects I worked with were first John Mockridge, who is now dead, and then Robin Boyd. And although the landscaping of the two motels was not probably the most significant of the design issues that we faced, certainly it was important, and it was something that helped to cement in my mind the significance of the totality of the design process. And on the second site, we had a very beautiful setting with many mahogany guns. And then when we formed Merchant Builders, it became very clear to me that we needed to find not only very talented architects, but also the most talented landscape architects practicing at the time. And after a deal of thought, we approached Ellis Stones, and he did all of the landscape work for Merchant Builders for the last, I think, 9 years of his life. And so I got to know him extremely well. And when he died, I decided that there wasn't anyone who quite fitted the bill here. There were some people who were doing interesting work. So I thought that it would be interesting to try and establish a firm of our own, which did some general planning work, but also was a landscape body and consulting firm. I was encouraged in that because I was starting to get quite a bit of work. People were asking for me to do things, and I thought it would be much simpler to have a a consulting firm associated with merchant builders to do that. I'd also formed a close friendship with an American called Pete Walker, who is a very distinguished landscape architect. He used to be at one stage, the dean of the Graduate School of Environment, no, the Graduate School of Design at Harvard, and had been the principal of a very large firm called Sasaki Walker in California. That's, I don't think, still operational, but he's still continues to practice, and I see him regularly. He came out here, I talked to him, and bit by bit, to cut a long story short, we assembled a group of landscape designers, and they did all of Merchant Builders' work, and then subsequently they separated off, and they now have a firm which has been going for quite a long time and have done very fine work, won many awards, and I'm still very, very closely not so much associated with them, but attached to them in a more of a friendship and other way.
What's the name of that firm?
Tract Consultants. So that further helped to develop my interest. And now, coming perhaps a little bit closer to the Garden History Society, I was invited to join the Committee of Inquiry into the National Estate in 1972, and that committee was given the task of surveying the state of Australia's heritage, its national estate, as it was then called. That involved looking at the natural history of Australia, the natural heritage of Australia, the prehistory and Aboriginal history of Australia, and the built and more recent history of Australia. We carried out that work and produced a report, and if you'd like to see a copy of that report, if you don't have one, you'll be most welcome to have that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Would you like me to get hold of that?
Oh, later on. Yes.
Later on?
Yes.
Okay. And at the conclusion of that report, there was a recommendation that a new body, which at that time we proposed should be called the National Estate Commission, should be formed to take responsibility for leading the protection of Australia's heritage. That recommendation was adopted by the two ministers. Tommy Wren was the principal minister, but Moscas was also involved. And to keep the process going, they appointed an interim committee, which I was asked to chair. That interim committee was called the Interim Committee of the National Estate. It had two tasks. One was to help to draft the legislation for the Australian Heritage Commission, and the second one was to start to administer and to shape the National State Grants Program. Both were very important roles. The first one because, of course, getting the legislation right for the Australian Heritage Commission was a very important task. And the second one was significant because a large sum of money was allocated in those early years for the protection of the national estate, a much larger sum than has ever been allocated since. It was a matter of some concern to everyone that this was spent well, and that it was spent properly and appropriately. So we had to try and work out on what basis this money should be spent and who it should go to. There were some requirements built into the program which were outside of our control. But by and large, Tom Uren, who again was the primary driver of this exercise, left the interim committee to have the main and often the full responsibility for determining where grants should go. Then, in 1975, the Australian Heritage Commission Act was passed by the Parliament. This is just before the end of the Whitlam era. And the Heritage Commission came into being, or would have come into being, if the cabinet appointees had been given vice-regal assent. But apparently those appointees were sitting on his desk on November the 11th in 1975, so he didn't, for one reason or another, get around to signing that document. And so at the time that the Whitlam government was dismissed, I was the only person appointed, because I had been appointed earlier as the new chair. So it took another year for the Fraser government to decide whether or not it wanted to continue on with the commission, and that was a very difficult period. But then, for one reason or another, Fraser did decide, yes, that it was appropriate that the Heritage Commission should continue to have a role in Australia. And so the rest of the commissioners were appointed and we set about our task. The most important task that we had was to establish the Register of the National Estate, which was a register that had been the details of which had been set out in the Heritage Commission Act. We had to decide what kind of a register would be appropriate. Most of the thinking at the time outside of the commission was that it would be a very small register of the, I suppose, national icons in the natural and historic areas. But we decided that it was more significant to have what might be called a representative register. And by that I mean that the register should be representative of the main strands of Australia's natural and cultural history. We realised that it would take a very long time for such a register to be developed, but we thought that this was a very appropriate role for the Commonwealth to play, not least because the register was not a fully protected register. By that I mean that the register applied only to the acts of the Commonwealth, because at that stage it was uncertain and maybe felt unlikely that the Commonwealth had the constitutional powers to determine what happened within the states. So we established, or we agreed to establish, a large register, and we then also agreed that we would go about establishing this register progressively. One of the reasons for establishing it progressively was that we knew that it would be controversial and that it would be easier to list the places that had the greatest degree of public acceptance, and then move progressively to others. So we decided we would begin with places that had already received recognition and enjoyed some status within state government or federal government jurisdictions, national parks and the like. We also agreed that we would begin with National Trust classified listings of buildings at that stage, since I don't think, if I'm right, there were in those initial listings any gardens. And we also went to, later on, to a great deal of trouble to go back over those listings and to improve the way in which they'd been described, the statements of significance that had been attached to them, because some were not very thorough at that time. But nevertheless, the Trust had done a marvellous job in getting that far. And then, progressively, we started to list a lot of other places, natural areas, Aboriginal sites, which were very difficult to work out because of all kinds of sensitivities related to Indigenous people, and the fact that some sites were, in their minds, sacred sites, and we had to be sure that what we did was going to be acceptable to them. So we began to assemble this very large register. And by the time I left, I think there were some 8,500 places on the register. I had a tenure of 6 years as the chairman of the Australian Heritage Commission, so that over the 5 years that we've been working on the register, bearing in mind my first year was one when the commission was in limbo, we moved from no places on the register to 8,500 on the register. We went through, I suppose, the obvious places, the places that were well known to different groups. Obviously, historic buildings were very well known to the trusts, even though, of course, further work had to be done, and there were always new places emerging. There were places of natural significance that were very well known, even if they hadn't received recognition of national parks, known to conservation bodies and scientists and so on. So our listings there were, I suppose, quite predictable, and so on. But then I was extremely keen, and so with other members of the commission, to start to look at the gaps in listings and to then set about trying to fill those gaps. We ran a conference on historic archaeology, because at that stage there were perhaps a handful of people around Australia interested in historic archaeology. We brought them all together at a conference, and it was absolutely electric, the atmosphere, because I think they had felt they were totally alone, and then they found these colleagues, and so that was good. And what we did was we used the grants from the National State Grants Program to help to bring about these conferences and these efforts to try and identify sites that were not on the main list. We also gave money to the states to develop historical themes so that it would be easier to see how different places might fit within that historical theme analysis. And so it came about that we started to pay attention to historic gardens. And I guess I was particularly interested in this. Indeed, I was interested in all of it, vitally interested, but perhaps took on a slightly more personal, active role here.
Why were you more interested in gardens, do you
think? Well, it wasn't so much that I was more interested in gardens. I think that perhaps the other people, the commission, who at that stage were not perhaps quite so involved. Mm-hmm. I think it was also because I was living in Melbourne. Peter Watts was a very, very important person in the development of the Garden History Society. As you know, he'd been working for the National Trust I can't remember what his specific title was, but he'd certainly started to carry out surveys. I think there was a grant from the Victorian government for that. And I'd spoken at a conference on, I can't remember what the theme of the conference was, but I think it was on historic gardens, yes, which the Trust ran. And I was asked to speak on that mostly because of my association with Ella Stones. And I also decided that I'd like to make the talk a talk about Edna Walling as well. As you know, is a very famous Australian landscape designer, because of the association between Edna Walling and Ella Stones, because Alice had undoubtedly been an acolyte of Edna Walling's. I was strongly encouraged by Peter Watts to do this, and indeed Peter and I did a lot of the research together for it. He came with me and we went and interviewed different people and looked at different gardens of hers. Ella Stone's work I didn't need the same amount of help with, and so on. And I think it was interesting that talk that I gave that evening was instrumental in part, or anyway, the research for it, in Peter Watts later on writing the book that he wrote on Edna Walling. But it was also instrumental in encouraging Anne Latreille to write her book on Ella Stones, because she rang me the next day and said that was absolutely fantastic. I was really intrigued. Do you want to write a book on Ella Stones? And I said, no, I don't personally, but there was someone working in our office at the time who was interested. So I said, I do have to check with her to see whether she still wants to go on with it. And I did that, and she said, no, she wasn't at the time. So I got back to Anne. I took Anne quite a long time after that to actually produce the book. But nevertheless, it was a conference that was similar in all kinds of ways. And that's perhaps how my engagement with historic gardens was strongly cemented. And so I don't want to suggest that, you know, I took an interest in historic gardens above all other aspects of the National Estate, because that certainly wouldn't be true. But it just so happened that I'd had this background, I'd given this paper, I'd worked with Peter Watts. The most interesting work in Australia at the time was being done, in a more systematic sense at least, was being done here by Peter Watts and the National Trust. So it was a natural thing, perhaps, for the Commission to work with the National Trust, and particularly with Peter Watts, to try and establish on a more systematic basis a process for identifying and listing historic gardens across Australia. And a key part of that process, of course, was to try and assemble together people who are interested in garden history, which at the time, as you would realise, was a fledgling activity with only a handful of people.
Now, who were those people?
Oh, now that's a good question. Who were those people?
Dame Elizabeth was one.
Yes, but I'm not thinking, and of course Dame Elizabeth was a very, very important person, but not so much in research. Mm-hmm. I would say that that the key people at the time, apart from Peter, were Howard Tanner, undoubtedly probably the most active working in Sydney. Um, there were other people who were really interested in gardens and for whom this notion of historic gardens was interesting and attractive. People like Miles Lewis, who's an architectural historian and a very, very good one. George Seddon, coming from a completely different background, and others. And then there were people who perhaps like Phil Simons had looked at pretty widely at Tasmanian gardens. I think that the list of people who contributed to the proceedings of the First Garden History Conference is a pretty accurate list from my viewpoint, mm-hmm. and I can't say that it's necessarily the most informed one, mm-hmm. of those who are doing the most interesting work at that time. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The other source would be that exhibition, Converting the Wilderness, the Art of Gardening in Colonial Australia, which, as I recall, Howard Tanner was primarily responsible for. Mm-hmm. And that had a catalogue, which I no longer have, I don't think. Mm-hmm. Have you seen that?
No, but that will be available. Mm-hmm.
That I think that's a very important document, mm-hmm. for you to get hold of.
So the year 1980 was really quite a logical time in this progressive process,
yes.
wasn't it, for the History Society to be started?
Yes, it was. Mm. It was because it was right in the middle of this really sort of significant burst of activity, which was associated with the Heritage Commission, mm. and its National Estate Grants programs. Now, I'm not saying, of course, that the Heritage Commission was doing everything that was valuable in Australia, but what I think it did do was provide resources, provide national backing for, and tremendous encouragement for all the other people, the key people who are doing work all over Australia. Mm-hmm. So it was, I think, a really appropriate time for something like the Garden History Society to come into being.
Mm. Were you involved in the very first meetings?
I was involved in the very first meeting. Mm-hmm. And this is the proceedings of the very first meeting. Do you have that document?
No, but the Society will have this.
Yes, okay.
Can you remember who was at that meeting?
No, I don't. I can remember that...
Would Joan Law Smith have been there? Was she an early member? Or Phil Simons?
Phil Simons would definitely have been there, mm-hmm. because she spoke.
Lady Ebury was another.
I don't actually remember Joan Law Smith being there. But she's been such a significant figure that I'm sure she would have been there if she could have been there. And I'm surprised if she had been there that she didn't speak. Mm. But that may just have been because she decided she didn't want to. But I just don't recall who was there.
Was Dame Elizabeth there right at the start?
She was there, yes. And she was elected at that meeting to be the first chair of the Garden History Society.
And she tells me that you very much encouraged her.
I did, yes.
Why did you do that?
Well, I talked to Peter, and we both agreed that she would be an ideal person to be the chair of the Garden History Society, because I have a tremendous interest in gardening, because of standing in Australian society, and for a whole host of reasons of that kind. Mm. And because she's, you know, such a warm-hearted supporter of so many different and interesting things. So,
did she fulfill your expectations?
Oh, I think so. But what I have to now say to you is this, that I didn't really have a very active part in the Garden History Society beyond helping to bring it into being. Because what I was working on was something slightly different. I was trying to assemble this register, and that, of course, had many, many other things. And my job was also, as chairman of the commission, was a part-time job, although I sometimes wondered what kind of a part-time job it really was, because it was, in those early days, so demanding, I mean, in a very good way. So I really didn't actively take part in garden history meetings.
I realise that, but this, what you've been telling me, is very important and interesting, because no one else I've spoken to has either had that knowledge or been able to remember the very early times.
Yes.
But someone like Sophie Ducker, for instance, who's been on a lot of tours, was excellent in recounting her memories of the early trips. So that part has been fairly well covered by the other people who joined the society once it was established and went on all their outings and really participated in the events of the society.
Yeah.
But your early memories are really important. And also, you mentioned what a great contribution Joan Law Smith made. In what way did she contribute?
Well, I don't know precisely what contribution she's made to the Garden History Society, but she's made a great contribution because the work she did at Bolebec was in itself a really interesting piece of garden design and so on.
We're talking about Joan Lawson.
Yes, because she's a very modest person, a very insightful person, I think, and she wrote beautifully too, a lot about gardens later in life, and she did that very well. But I again don't know quite what her relationship was with the historic gardens. I think Peter Watts would tell you more accurately what was that relationship.
Mm. Now, when the society was first formed, did it have a particular philosophy?
The Garden History Society?
Was a collective agreement about why it should be formed and about what it should do amongst those early people?
Well, I think it probably used this conference to try and look at a whole range of different issues to do with garden history. To draw upon the experience of the United Kingdom, because to the conference was invited a man named Fawcett, who I think had been the chair of the UK garden history body, whatever that was called. He spoke at the conference, so he was able to give us a picture of what had been done there and the approach that had been taken, so that there was that background. There were papers from different people talking about different aspects of Australia's garden history or approaches to it. So the conference, I think, was used to flesh out an approach that might be taken. In Peter Watts' paper, as I recall it, there were a set of criteria developed, for garden history listings, and they were drawn significantly from the criteria that had been adopted in Britain. And I think one of them was that historic gardens, if I remember rightly, could not be more recent than the 1920s, and then that was later extended to the 1930s, and probably it's been extended much since then, because the listings of historic buildings have progressively moved further and further up the 20th century. And I would imagine on the Register of the National Estate now, there are plenty of buildings that would be late 20th century buildings. So I would expect that there would be equally gardens now on the Register of the National Estate, or which are of interest to the Garden History Society, that are much later than those early ones. Mm-hmm. So at the conference, there were all these various attempts to try and get a sense across of what's actually been happening up to now, who's been doing it, what other places have been doing, other countries have been doing, what therefore might be a starting point for the work of the Garden History Society. And from the point of view of the Heritage Commission, what we were interested in was the listing, or the identification, evaluation and listing of historic gardens. The process that we used was to invite nominations, or sometimes to commission studies, which would lead to nominations for places to be put on the Register of the National Estate, to then examine those places to make sure that they had appropriate statements of significance, that the statements of significance warranted them being put on the register, then to advertise them, and advertise them reasonably widely, and then to deal with comments and objections to them. And after we'd received comments and objections, if there were any, to then decide, to then make the decision to list or not to list. So that would have been the process that we would have looked to as a development of the work of the Garden History Society, that the people involved in the Garden Histories would be helping us to identify those key places and put them on the register.
Now, the History Society have more of a purpose than just working out which garden should be registered. The History Society
have. Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
And what was that purpose?
Well, I think you best ask other people to see how that's developed. But it was obviously to exchange information amongst those interested in historic gardens, to be concerned with issues of restoration and maintenance of historic gardens, be concerned with research into the sort of plantings that would have been carried out at particular periods, and the degree to which perhaps those plantings are still to be seen, and plant species are still to be seen in historic gardens, and so all those kinds of things. So much, much wider ambit than the Heritage Commission's ambit. Our concern was simply to bring those gardens into prominence, and thereby to help their protection.
As far as you know, did the society get off to a good start with an enthusiastic and growing membership?
Yeah, to my knowledge, got off to a very enthusiastic start.
Mm-hmm.
But again, it would be best, I think Peter Watts is the key person.
Yes.
Have you talked to him yet?
No, because he's in Sydney. So the Sydney crowd are being interviewed separately.
Yes.
This is just the Victorian.
So you're doing only the Victorian? Mm. Yes, mm. Okay.
Mm.
Yes. But he was a key person. And as I say, I had much to do with him in the work that I was doing.
Mm.
And
how important was Phil Simons? You mentioned her.
I think she's important, but I don't think I would be in a position to tell you just how important.
Mm-hmm.
She's got a chapter in here, which is called The Genesis of Tasmanian Gardens. To my knowledge, she was important in a Tasmanian context,
mm-hmm.
and that's significant in itself, but I don't recall that she was important in the more general sense.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's not to belittle her in any way at all. What she did related to, or was doing related to, Tasmanian Gardens was obviously very significant, but I'm just trying to give you a sense of what seemed to be happening in trying to bring the Garden History Society into being.
Mm. Was there anyone in the Victorian membership who was particularly important that you know of?
Well, there were significant people like Norman Wettenhall, mm-hmm. who was a... I think he was on the... he was very close, he was the deputy president or president of the National Trust for quite some time. He was always very interested in gardens, and so I think that he would have been very actively interested. Then there were two professors at the University of Melbourne, John Turner and Carrick Chambers, who I know both took a great deal of interest in gardens such as Rippenley. Carrick is now in Sydney, and he went there to run the Botanic Gardens in Sydney, so he carried some of that interest across there. I can certainly remember that Norman Wettenhall was present at that meeting.
And what were his particular interests and skills?
Well, I think I'm just really trying to think, but I think he had just always taken a tremendous amount of interest in the trust's gardens, and particularly gardens such as Rippenley. And on that account, I was active and supportive of an initiative like that, and he was always a person who was a front runner in trying to help to bring bodies like this into being, and activities such as the activities with which the Garden History Society is concerned into being. I can remember that Alethea Russell was there. She and her husband at that stage used to own Wallach in the Western District, which is a guilfoyle garden, a very beautiful guilfoyle garden. And I suppose there were quite a lot of other people, and historic gardens there. I'm just trying to think who else I can remember. This document doesn't actually unfortunately list the people attending. But there may well, I mean, I would hope there was a minute of the first meeting. In fact, it seems surprising that there wasn't.
Yes, there would be. From your personal point of view, were there any particular gardens that you felt were most important at that time?
Oh, well, there were the obvious ones, such as the Botanic Gardens. Yeah, and some of the Guilfoyle Gardens around the state. I suppose they were the best known. Just trying to think. I try and look up in the register, the Heritage of Australia. I try to look up to see what was listed there. But the index doesn't actually refer to historic gardens at all, which is unfortunate. So it's difficult to identify what was included at that time, because you'd have to go right through the whole book to find them.
Mm-hmm. I just thought perhaps you might have
been. Yeah, this was published in 1981. And, you know, there's certainly a big piece on here on there's a long piece on the Botanic Gardens by Carrick Chambers.
Yes, just while you're looking at that, do you think the Society has been successful?
Well, what I can gather has been amazingly successful. I went to a dinner about a year ago, which they kindly invited me to, and I just simply couldn't believe that the membership was so large. That's quite extraordinary how it's grown, and that's been wonderful. I can't also believe that everyone who is a member attended that dinner, but the ANZ Pavilion at the Art Centre was absolutely full.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Are you aware of its activities these days?
Not really, no. Mm-hmm. Now, I've not kept much in touch with what it's been doing, because what I've been doing has moved away from that fairly significantly.
Mm-hmm. Tom Garnett was another early member.
Tommy Garnett would certainly. Now, again, I don't remember him being there, but he was obviously a very important person.
Mm. In what ways do you think he was important?
Well, just what he was doing himself, because he wrote that column regularly in The Age. Mm. I think that Anne Luttrell used to edit that section. Mm. And so Tommy Garnett used to write regularly for her. Mm. So,
so as far as you know, its original purpose has stayed much the same, hasn't changed its ideas or its aims?
Again, I'm not in a position to tell you, so I really wouldn't know, but I would imagine that by and large its original purpose has stayed the same, but as with most bodies like this, the thinking about it has matured, been other dimensions which have been brought into play.
And you had no personal interest in any particular gardens that you felt should be registered at the time, did you?
No direct.
No.
Interest in them, always, like everyone else, I suppose, greatly admired gardens such as the Botanic Gardens.
Mm.
And gardens such as Warlock, but No, I had no direct personal interest in, in them. So I suppose my part, to the extent that I had any significant part, was all related to the beginning of the society and the background to the establishment of the society, but not to its further and later development.
Now, as I said, that's been very important. Thank you.
I'm just trying to find the piece on the Botanic Gardens in here, but anyway, it's not that important.
Now that's the one that's just come out, is it? This
book? No, no. This was published in 1981, and it might be worth taking a look at that. I wrote a before I left the commission. I thought that it would be
Heritage History of Australia.
I thought it would be a useful thing to do to just survey what the commission had done. So. I set out what I felt were the was a sort of a useful summary of the things that the commission had attempted to do and where things were with different categories of places, and that's a piece that I wrote on historic gardens.
This is in the National State in 1981, piece by David Yenkin on Historic Gardens, on page 129.
Okay, now is that useful to you?
Yes, but the society will have that, won't it?
I presume they will, not necessarily. Do you want to take a copy?
I'll check up first whether they
all right, ready. Okay. Mm. So the 1998, it had a second name when it was reprinted. It was reprinted as, I think, something that the Rattle of the Commonwealth. Anyway, it doesn't matter.
No, that's it. I'll just switch this on.